Master Approves. It's the SAFTAcast, and I'm your host, Scott C. How you doing, everyone? Folks, we got a great program for you today, but before we get there, it is time for the news real quick. What are you doing this Sunday? Are you doing anything special, particular, anything interesting? Because if you are not, and you happen to be in the Knoxville area, then swing on by the award-winning SAFTA Reading Series, which is once again back in Knoxville at the Birdhouse, 3 p.m. this time around. Our wonderful guests are Maureen Thorson and Darius Stewart. This promises to be all kinds of all sorts of awesome. Seriously, check this out. That is the Birdhouse at 3 p.m. this Sunday, November 9th. If you've missed any of the reading series, there is a way to get a little sample, a little taste of each guest, and that is if you hop on over to the Sundress Publications YouTube channel. Yes, Sundress Publications does have a YouTube channel. I know they're a writers group primarily, but they do some video stuff and everything. If you hop on over to the Sundress YouTube channel by going over to YouTube and searching Sundress Publications, you can check out some of the reading series' past guests as they read their work. You can check out SAFTA promotional videos, and a lot more is there, and a lot more is coming as time goes on. Hey, you know one of the things that SAFTA does is the SAFTAcast. And did you know that we are on Facebook? We have a Facebook page officially. Yes, we do. We also have a Twitter at SAFTAcast. So follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Ask questions of our future guests. We are going to start announcing who our next guests are going to be and allow you, the listeners, the chance to ask questions. And as you know, for regular listeners know to this program, we are willing to ask pretty much anything, as long as it's not about the work. So, you want to find out how a future guest enjoys their hamburgers dressed? You can ask that. Tell us what you thought of an episode. Tell us what you thought of one of our promos. Tell us you had a fruit cup at lunch. Tell us you packed a fruit cup for lunch, didn't eat it, totally forgot about the fruit cup, and left it in a warm car for a whole afternoon, and then finally threw out that fruit cup that evening while feeling a small bit of embarrassment and shame. Whatever it may be. Folks, one more thing. If you happen to listen to us and you enjoy this program, why not hop on over on iTunes and rate us, review us? It takes you a couple minutes. It's not that difficult. You need to have an Apple ID to log in, but it's okay. You might already have one anyway sitting around. Give us a little rating. Review us. Let us know what you think about the program. It boosts our visibility, and it makes us a premier little show. Speaking of premier little shows, premier episode, rather, today's episode features young filmmaker Jameson Stallsworth and, oh boy, man loves Halloween, the man loves horror movies, and when you get a film critic and a filmmaker together on the same show, it just becomes a talk about their favorite films. So in this one, we tackle James Cameron and why he's good and why he's bad at times. We tackle Michael Bay, the master of what I call piss and boom filmmaking. In other words, I'm going to piss on your childhood, and if I can, I'm going to blow it up. We talk about what makes good movies bad, what makes bad movies good, and a lot more stuff. We even actually talk about a little bit of work and how our guest Jameson got into the filmmaking business in the first place. And of course, you can check out some of his work with the SAFTA films by checking out Curse of the Were-Clown and Bad Bunny, which we will link on the website at saftacast.com. But first, before we hear from him, you should hear from the theme song.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, it's been a little bit of a hassle to get this going, but
it has been an adventure for sure.
Technology, man. Telling
it's,
you.
That's part of the hardships of living in the future is the way I see it.
Hardships of being an artist in general, I think, now in the tech age. And you know about that, being an editor and working with, geez, man, back when I was doing film, it was Final Cut Pro at best.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, technology is kind of, as technical as I am, I'm very untechnical. So I try to avoid technology, but you can't these days.
No. Actually, now that I think about it, it wasn't even Final Cut Pro. It was Toaster. That's what I learned on.
I've never even used Toaster for anything like that.
That was my video editing systems.
That's strange.
Yeah. Archaic, man. Archaic.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, how was your Halloween?
My Halloween was pretty good. It was actually quite laid back, which was good because I was very tired before Halloween even, you know, kicked in. But it was all fun and easy going. But now I'm kind of having my Halloween withdrawals. And, you know, it seems to have come so quickly, and now I'm just kind of I'm starting to miss it now, and it's another long year before it comes back around.
Are you one of those people that spends like 2 months enjoying Halloween?
Yeah, typically I am, but not so much this year. Just being busy, being caught up with other things. Usually, like right at the end of August, I really start getting into the spirit, and it starts the leaves start to turn, and the air gets cold, and it just starts to feel like Halloween. And so I'm just like, let's get the decorations, let's go shopping for costumes and makeup and masks and. You know, I get all into it, but this year it kind of came and went really fast, and so I feel like I sort of missed it, but at the same time, I think I got my fill.
You could extend it into Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's always the thing, is I like to drag Halloween out. I'm like, it's still fall, you know, it's a fall holiday, you know, extend it, you know, drag it out, keep up the Halloween decorations, but then my wife is like, the second Halloween is over, she's like, it's time to put up the Christmas tree. And I'm just like, no, it's too soon. It's like, I'm not done with Halloween yet.
So how do you keep that Halloween spirit going then, despite the family going, no, now it's time to put up turkeys and trees?
The easiest way of doing it is just by being lazy and not taking down the Halloween decorations. If you put up as many Halloween decorations as possible, it becomes such a job to try to take them down that it usually takes you to the early December before you get all the scarecrows and creepy ghosts and things off of your house. And so I get to come home and be like, it's still Halloween. I still got bats and spiders hanging up. And then, of course, if you can pad out eating and consuming all the Halloween candy.
Just in time for the Christmas candy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, like, once you start running out of the Halloween, then it's time to go get candy canes, and it kind of blends. That's sort of the transition is candy for me, anyway.
You could also merge your Halloween decorations outside. You could have, like, Santa in the Kingdom of the Spiders.
You know, I always thought it would be interesting to kind of have, you know, a very Halloween-looking Santa. You know, maybe just start dressing up, you know, skeletons as Santa Claus, and then when you're... pumpkins start to turn green and mushy, you know, that's perfect Christmas colors. Just throw some lights on it, and it doesn't quite work out that way.
Get a robotic or animatronic Santa, or even just a standstill Santa, and an axe or a candy cane, and a bunch of toy skeletons.
Exactly.
And have them just wage war on your lawn.
Just slowly start moving. Have the decorations, the Halloween decorations on one end of the lawn, Christmas on the other end. Slowly move them in the middle of the yard, just day by day, like the two fronts of war just coming together.
Let's see what Santa has in his sack for you. You've been very naughty, undead.
And the neighbors just staring out. It's like, this has gone too far.
Who knows? You might get a prize or something for that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's At a certain point, and I'm not sure when it is, but there is a drop off where all of a sudden I start really getting into the Christmas spirit, and the Christmas spirit will override the Halloween blues. It's typically how it happens. So
you use Nightmare Before Christmas as the transition movie.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the perfect movie. Not only from a marketing standpoint, that's, oh yeah, we can play it on TV, you know, for both holidays, but it really is the best transition. You know, when you're getting into the Halloween spirit, you watch it, get all excited, and then you start to lull back into Christmas, and you can still watch it. So that's a good kind of calming, tranquil medicine for these panicky transitions.
Except for Hot Topic taking it over, basically.
Well, it's really weird. I was all right with Hot Topic. What's very strange to me is walking into the Disney store and seeing all of the creepy Nightmare Before Christmas toys and things like that. But at the same time, I try not to complain because I was 5 years old when that movie came out. Like I was five when I finally got it on VHS to watch it. And now I have a 5 year old of my own and he absolutely loves it. And we went into Walgreens the other day and Walgreens had tons of Nightmare Before Christmas toys and coffee mugs and costumes. And so I bought him toys and he was so happy to have a Jack Skellington doll. And I'm like, this stuff really wasn't around when I was a kid. It was more obscure. You couldn't really find the Jack Skellington toys. And now they're like, in every store on every street corner. And that much is like, this has kind of become like Star Wars in that way. So
you must be proud, though, standing there and be like, yes, you are truly my son.
Oh, yeah. It's so strange because, like, I thought it's like, I'm not going to show him. I'm not going to, like, sit him down and, like, you need to watch this movie I watched when I was a kid. I didn't want to just force my childhood onto him. And still he found it and he was like, what is this? It's like, oh, this is a movie I used to watch when I was a kid. I want to watch it. And he watched it over and over and over. So he just genetically was drawn to it. He came by it very honestly.
His Let It Go was your Kidnap the Santa Claus.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they enjoyed the Frozen too, but not nearly as much as they love Nightmare Before Christmas. All of the kids love it, and that makes me proud. So,
are you going to let them discover other films like that on their own, or are you going to nudge them in any directions?
I think I'll try to, I guess, guide them in a way. Like, I don't want to just present to them all these creepy movies, but, like, they definitely, at least with my older son, he definitely has that same sort of fascination I had when I was a kid. So he'll see something in my movie collection, he'll be interested and ask questions about it. So I start answering him, and then I was like, here, I'll show you a few scenes, and then, he's, comes away, it's like, wow, so that's what Clockwork Orange is all about. And I'm like, yes, don't tell your mother that I let you watch that.
Well, you just kind of admitted it now.
we actually haven't gotten there yet, but I remember when I was young, my dad sort of did the same thing to me. He told me about the movie, but he said, I think if I recall, the movie might be a little rough for your age.
It was definitely rough on me at 16.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I was 14 or 15 when I watched it, and it threw me through a loop. I mean, I knew it was rough, but, not even content-wise, it was twisted.
Nothing prepared me for Roddy McDowall smashing an old man with a giant penis.
It was definitely a bizarre coming-of-age film, because it's not really a coming-of-age film, if you think about it. But it seems everybody discovers that movie when they're between the ages of 14 and 16, and it kind of wrecks them in some sort of wonderful way.
Did you have any movies like that when you were a teenager that just completely wrecked your ideas about film and everything?
I definitely think that was one of them. And that one, it was really bizarre because that one excited me. I love the way it was shot, the cinematography, the energy in that one. And the music that went with it just kind of, it felt like it was getting inside my brain and doing strange things to me while I watched it. There's a very sort of hypnotic feel when you watch that movie. And I remember when the closing credits came up, I felt really exhilarated and excited, like, wow, that was a great movie. And still very deeply disturbed, and I didn't feel like going to sleep that night. It was a very bizarre experience. And another film that oddly did somewhat the same thing, and it's a bit unknown. There's not a lot of people that have seen it, but it's Gus Van Sant's Elephant, which essentially is kind of a take on the Columbine shooting. And it's really not a very particularly great movie, but I happened to watch that one when I was 14 or 15, and it seemed to to hit on the note just quite perfectly. And I felt very unnerved and disturbed, and also at the same time, very grateful that I'd gotten to see that film.
Kids did it for me.
Yes, yes. Which is a movie I've actually not seen yet. But yeah, that one seems to be on people's list quite a bit.
That was one that in my teen years I can think back that really just kind of messed with my head and went, what the hell am I seeing?
Yeah, yeah. Those movies are so very few, and I think typically because they don't tend to do very well in box office or just reception-wise, but then they sort of sneak under the radar and then become these sort of underground films that when you finally watch it, it just hits on senses that you didn't realize that you even had. And a few of those are great when you finally get to see one of those.
Yeah, I've had a few, I would say, watershed films in my lifetime.
Yeah.
That stuck with me. When I was a kid, I watched Stand By Me on HBO. I learned to swear because of that movie. And, you know, I like to joke now I'm a New Yorker, and so I think the word motherfucker at least once an hour. But I really think it's all due to Stand By Me. To this day, I will go around, and nobody around me knows the reference, but I'll just go, oh, come on. If we don't get there, the kid won't be dead anymore.
You know, I seem to remember seeing, I saw that when I was, I forgot where I'd even seen that movie, but it was on TV somewhere, so I think a lot of it was bleeped out, but I remember just seeing it when I was very young and just getting really excited and like running around the house during the commercial break and telling everybody, you need to watch this movie that's on right now. It's just completely different than any movie I've ever seen, which is weird because Stand By Me is a very, it's kind of a happy sort of cheery film on the outside. Like you seem to remember all these kind of cutesy funny moments. And then at the same time, you can remember it as a completely different film. It's just being just dark and cold and twisted in some weird way.
That ending is extremely chilling
when
he gives the final narration of them growing apart and we find out what happens to each of them, and it leads to that killer line of friends come in and out of your life like busboys in a restaurant.
Exactly.
Something about that just chilled me to the bone as a kid.
Yeah. And especially when, you know, when those closing images, you're seeing them still together. And at the same time, then you realize that it leaves you with that sort of empty feeling that your childhood is a ghost.
And I find it fascinating that really King's best work on film has always been his non-supernatural stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's very much true. And I think it's a lot to the sense that the supernatural stuff really can only exist in his pages. I think when you try to change the formula and the format, you start to believe it a little less. But when he's writing it in the book, at least the way that he writes the supernatural events, you just believe every word of it. But then you know, you see
Jimmy Smits having to fight a green glowing thing, or Bronson Pinchot in the Langoliers going up against a ball of teeth.
Yes, yes. And then or you get a giant spider at the end of It, and you're just like, what on earth? But when you read it from the page, you're just like, I can't believe it. It is this giant spider. That's crazy. I totally believe it. Which also, you know, that brings up a point, and I tried to explain this to someone who was a Stephen King fan, and they seem to agree with me, and I've not read a lot of Stephen King, but I always got the feeling that in watching these films, the Stephen King films, they would have done better if they had been animated films. And a lot of people hear me say that, and I said, what? That's the most ridiculous thing. But if you see, you know, I guess if you look at anime or some of the serious drama type of animated series and imagine a Stephen King storyline being done that same way, then all of those things that don't translate into the film quite that same way, I think would be captured a lot better in that format. And I always wanted to see an animated Stephen King film.
I think that's the only way they could do maybe the Dark Tower series.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so many, and that's, you know, I have not read the series, but, you know, in talking to people who have and just describing it, and, you know, I could only picture it in my mind as this very, you know, strange and dark sort of animated thing.
They had some success at Marvel with translating it into comic books, along with The Stand. And I think it's just absolutely stunning.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, in the same way that comic books would work the same way, too. And, of course, I don't even know if Stephen King is, like, a fan of comic books. It seems like he is. But I don't think I've ever heard him say that in an interview, or maybe I'm just imagining it. But it seems like Stephen King is a big comic book fan.
I could see him easily being a fan of the old EC comics from the 50s, Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, especially Creepshow. I think he wrote the whole film.
And then he stars at the end of it.
His son was also in the first one.
Creepshow is one of the few horror films that I have trouble watching that still scares me.
Really?
Yeah, and it's that final bit, the crate.
Yes.
The second part, I should say. The third one is Stephen King as farmer being overtaken by grass, but
yeah,
the crate still freaks me out.
The first time I watched it, it had the same effect. Something about it, and I don't know what it is. It must just be the teeth. I think the teeth were done in such a way that it was just too much, and I just couldn't handle it the first time I watched it. The creature's name, I think it's Fluffy was the nickname that was given to him by the filmmakers when they were making it. But it was just very well done. The suspense was built up in such a way that you finally see this you know, weird, bizarre-looking puppet, and it's just unhinges your mind. You're just, oh, God. I can't look at it.
Are there horror films for you that you can't sit through?
There was a number of them. One of them that really affected me in that way, and I love horror films, but every now and then I'll, especially when I go to the theater, which to me is the best place to experience a horror film, no matter what horror film it is, even if it's a bad one, if you're in a theater with a group of people, that's the way to do it. And there's a number of them where the suspense starts building up so much and I feel something bad is about to come that I have to kind of avert my eyes because the intensity is a little too much. And the one film that I think that did that to me the most was The Ring, which I forgot when it came out. I think I was still in high school when that one came out. And I've since gone back and watched the original Japanese version. But there was something... For one thing, that film was very unique when it came out. It was the first of its kind, and it was the kind of film that really made you feel like you were somehow being sucked into it at the same time that it was being blown out at you. And I remember just feeling I think I was even trembling a little bit when the credits came up, and I thought, wow, that was incredible.
I'm going to have to differ with you. I enjoyed it up until the horses being thrown off the boat, because my brain, for whatever reason, at that moment thought of Jim Morrison and the Doors and the track Horse Latitudes. So I'm watching, I'm watching the horses run off the boat, and I'm hearing in my head Jim Morrison screaming, "The first one is jettisoned." And after that, I couldn't take the movie seriously anymore.
It just becomes a music video for the Doors after that. Just
after that, and it's like, I understand it's a good film, but...
I think that had happened, I would have been completely off the film at that point.
It's like The Happening. M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong and his, yeah. The suicide by plant and air.
Yeah. Oh, people go completely crazy when I tell them that I absolutely loved The Happening.
Explain yourself.
For whatever reason, I thought The Happening was not the least bit scary. I know I didn't even feel that it was even creepy, but something about it was just so entertaining to me. And I think it was the fact that I realized that this was a movie you just can't take seriously, whether it was meant to or not. You just couldn't take it seriously. And to me, it felt like M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong was trying to just find the most obscure villain he could, in kind of the same way that Hitchcock did The Birds. You take something, of course, M. Night is nowhere near Hitchcock, even though I thought he could have been with some of his earlier stuff, but Killer Trees is just the most ridiculous concept I think has ever been in film. And of course, it does the most ridiculous thing. It makes you want to kill yourself in a very, very entertaining way. Not even just kill yourself, but people just went out to find the most entertaining way to kill themselves.
And then again, I can't take it seriously because the guy gets his arm ripped off in a lion pit, and I'm just going, it's a flesh wound. Because he dances exactly like the Black Knight at that moment. The whole audience, I saw it in theaters, we all laughed. And after I think you're right. If you think of it as a B movie.
Yeah. And there's moments in it, and it just seems like he was trying to just fuck with his audience. But I think he stands by that movie, and he was even, saying how proud he was to have finally done a rated R movie. I think it was his first rated R movie. But for whatever reason, if you go through, you can just pinpoint all the moments that are just kind of like surreal comedies. There's some sort of army general that kept uttering cheese and crackers throughout the whole thing, or I can't remember the scene, but it was, I think, the man who finally proposed to the cast of characters that it was the trees killing everybody, kept staring at everybody with this weird lazy eye look. And I mean, when we watched it in the theaters, I mean, it was hard not to just laugh at these ridiculous moments.
You eyeing my lemon drink.
Oh, and I mean, you watch the movie, and I can't buy that he was writing it and not just giggling to himself, thinking this is going to be on a big screen somewhere.
So he's like Michael Bay then. Michael Bay's trolling us, basically.
I think Michael Bay is just, I think he's just in it for, he's just going to make a movie that's going to make millions of dollars in the box office. I think he's got his formula down. And I think that's not to say that he's just in it for the money, but it's hard to say that he's an artistic filmmaker at any length. I think whatever it is that Michael Bay has going on in his brain, he always manages to make tons of money with whatever film it is.
I totally agree. The guy has like something close to a Mensa IQ, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah. And if you can stand to watch his films, you'll see throughout the entire thing that he's actually an incredible director. But for whatever reason, he chooses to make these kind of films that you would never consider great classics. But I mean, you watch his fingerprint on a film is very recognizable and extremely well crafted.
The guy knows his craft. I will agree with you. He knows his craft. He just ends up making these films.
Yes. But, I consider him a blockbuster maker. He's always after the big films. I think he's the kind of filmmaker that James Cameron tries to be with, Avatar, which, took him a supposed 10 years to finally get together. But at the same time, Michael Bay will make something at the same level as Avatar, maybe even better, and he'll be able to churn these out in, one every year if he wanted to, and then have people lined around the block with each film he makes. There's just a huge line going around the block of people trying to get in. I mean, he's a manufacturer of the blockbuster.
Cameron can do the same, but Cameron is also, he can't help but also throw some level of depth into his films.
Yeah, I think he puts himself very much into his films. And you look at him and you think, especially, with Avatar and Titanic and these films that you're just like, oh my goodness, are you kidding me? But there's definitely his spirit being poured into it in a way that Michael Bay just doesn't do. But it's very unusual that, he would talk so lovingly about something like Avatar, which had beautiful imagery, and then just had a terrible story.
I watched it, and I'm like, I tell my students this when I talk about Avatar. I hate the film. It's beautiful. Oh, it's gorgeous. But I'm watching it the first time, and I'm like, I've seen this movie before, and it's called Ferngully.
Yeah.
And about a half hour later, I'm like, I've seen this movie before. It's called Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, oh yeah. Absolutely.
And then the mechs come in and Cameron's signature move, the blue strobe light, and Sigourney Weaver and mechs, and I just went, I've seen this movie before. It's called Aliens, and you directed it, Cameron.
I mean, but yeah, it's absolutely true. It's, and it's like, you know, when I finally watched it, I didn't even get all the way through it. I think I've managed to watch the entire film, but just by getting like bits and pieces, because that's all I really needed. You know, it's like he spent the 10 years building this film, just drawing pictures, and then at the last minute had to come up with a story. And it's the whole thing is of the moment I heard or discovered or learned that the storyline was a group of people trying to obtain something called unobtainium. I was like, I'm done.
Look, I can handle MacGuffins, but you gotta, come on, man.
You gotta disguise it as something, you gotta make it something worth, but you know, that was the most, it was written in a script and was supposed to be changed to something else, and then they just never got around to it. I don't know.
It would have been so much better if we had Sigourney Weaver just saying, get away from her, you bitch.
Yeah.
I would instantly respect the film so much more.
but definitely some very interesting visuals in there. The one particular that really stuck out to me is Cameron snuck in Avatar a Patton reference. I forget the scene and I forget the general's name. That's the character that's in there, but he's rallying the troops. He's speaking to them and he turns around and he's standing in front of this giant window and he's backlit by this window. And at the same time, he's turned around and standing there. The shot is filmed just straight on of him standing in front of this window, which has these blinds going horizontally across. And in the upper left corner, there's a giant AC unit or something that's very square. And the camera lines up in just such a way that he forms the American flag with the window and the AC unit, just as his general turns around and is standing there. And I saw it, and I don't think nobody else seemed to have saw it, but I thought, that's Patton.
Navi, you magnificent bastards, I read your book.
And it was that moment. Like, it's like, you can hate this movie all you want, but you still have to love James Cameron, which I really do, even though I can't stand to watch that movie.
Don't lose respect for him. I still enjoy his films. Even Titanic. The last third of that movie is well done.
Oh, yeah. And the weird thing is, like, every time it comes on TV or something, or somebody's watching it, I always sit down, I'm like, oh, here's this movie again. And I always get completely drawn into it. It's a very captivating movie, and you're just like, you want to roll your eyes and groan at the love story and everything. But then at the same time, I say to myself, you know, this was a good idea. Let's tell a sappy love story on the Titanic. And that much, and then of course, you know, the great, you know, fantastic finally getting to watch the boat sink after 2 hours. He definitely gives you that as a reward, I think. I think if you were bored with the love story, then he's like, all right, here we go. The boat's going down for the next 40 minutes. And
all right, you guys in the audience, here we go. 1,500 dead in a few minutes. More death than a Rambo film.
I remember when I was a kid, after that movie came out, I used to love drawing comic books, and I started it and I never finished it, and I think I finally lost it, but I did a parody of Titanic almost scene for scene, except it was the Hindenburg, and I never got to the end. I was trying to figure out, how am I going to parody the ending of Titanic with the Hindenburg, and I finally decided, it's like, you know what, I'm just going to blow it up in the end. But
how could you climb to the stern of it as it's going down?
Oh, it's just burning skeletons and flesh just melting off of these two crispy bodies coming together and having the scene before they turn to ash or something like that. I don't know, but I think the idea that I just thought it would be a humorous trying to do the same thing with the Hindenburg as he did with Titanic.
So are you much of a comic person then?
I'm really not. Well, I don't read a lot of comic books, but I've always loved comic books, and I especially love more the underground comic books rather than, you know, the Marvel or DC comics. And when I was a kid, I got into the Tales from the Crypt comic books, which were kind of hard to find at the time. But I remember going through these giant Tales from the Crypt volumes that had like passages and had issues printed in them, and just finding it just incredibly entertaining. And I used to love drawing comic books when I was a kid, but mostly that was a way of trying to make a movie on paper because I was stuck in school all day and couldn't be playing with the camera. So
the movie bug kind of gets you early in life.
It really did. And in fact, I think if I think back, I think it was around the age of 3 or so that I really started to kind of get into the idea that, you know, people make movies. You know, movies don't just happen. Somebody is making them. Somebody is using a camera, and there's actors and costumes and makeup and special effects. I think the earliest attempt I made at making a movie, I was about 3, maybe 4, and I got really fascinated with the idea of one actor playing multiple characters. So I tried to play multiple characters in some sort of film, which was essentially just me standing in front of the camera dressed up, and then I would turn the camera off and try to change outfits real quick and then come by. There was no story or anything. I was just fascinated with the idea that you could stop what was, you know, reality, change everything around, and then just pick it up right where you left off. Of course, I have no idea what happened to that, but and probably got a tape got stepped on or something like
probably
that.
Probably for the best.
Yeah. I think it's better. It's more impressive and satisfying in my mind than it would be if I went back and watched it and it was just a babbling toddler with the hats and shirts on my head. But
yeah, you don't want to revisit your old tapes, trust me on that.
Well, it's really odd because throughout my childhood I did create a hefty library of VHS tapes of all these movies that I made with neighborhood friends and siblings and early attempts at stop motion, and I still have all of those. And in fact, I'm here in my office, and I've got a huge drawer that's just filled with VHS tapes. And it's been a long time since I've watched through any of them, and I may never watch through them again. But
you might want to digitize them because we both know magnetic tape goes bad. I'm starting to think that maybe I should spend some time with the 200 plus videotapes I have back at home, including at least 100 plus of me. And very similar to you, my friend and I did our own TV channel. And, you know, we would do our own shows and all that and make our own. I think we did something like over 100 episodes, you know, full 2 to 4 hour episodes.
Oh, wow.
Those tapes are starting to decay now.
Oh, yeah. And that's kind of the net. You know, I bought a big editing tape deck just so I could start digitizing some of these. But the plan is to go through some of the old family videos that I managed to archive and keep safe. You know, those, I guess, are the more important ones than just me, you know, playing with G.I. Joes in front of the camera. But that is the ultimate goal. So that's why I've tried to keep them as preserved as possible. And now I have the ability to go through and it's what to do with them after that. I have no idea.
So between the childhood tapes and the teen movies and such, did you pretty much know when you went off to school and college and everything what you were going to do?
I think I always had it in my head that I wanted to make films. Even as a childhood, it was hard to envision doing anything else. I didn't really have any interest in anything, but I knew that I wanted to be involved with filmmaking. And then in high school, it definitely, you know, came back on me strong, and I started watching more serious films. And, you know, it just wasn't, you know, the children's comedies, which still fascinated me as a kid. And I started to watch the more serious movies. I started getting into, you know, Terry Gilliam became my favorite director. I want to make movies like that. And then, you know, going to college, it was a little disheartening because, you know, at one end, I wanted to go to film school and I was checking out film schools and my parents are just saying, there's no way we're going to be able to send you to a film school. And it was kind of heartbreaking. And then at the other end, I started listening to, you know, you would hear in an interview from Quentin Tarantino, who he's saying, don't spend your money on film school. And Lloyd Kaufman saying, oh, stay away from film school. You can learn everything from, you know, a little pamphlet. And so then I started getting into that and I started thinking, well, you know, like, maybe I should go to film school, get, you know, real film education, or I should be one of these people trying to do it on my own. And I got real conflicted there. But in the end, I couldn't go to film school anyhow, so that pretty much settled the matter. So I decided to go, you know, for video technologies, television. You know, that was easily accessible and it was about as close as I could get. But for a while there, I didn't feel like, you know, that was really where I wanted to be.
Well, you were kind of ahead of the curve because as we're seeing with serial television now, it's practically becoming movie.
Well, yeah, it was a really weird, discovery. I think when I went into video production, I felt like, you know, this is going to be, you know, this is just going to teach me how to make wedding videos for the rest of my life, which was something I really wasn't interested in. And then there's, you know, teaching, you know, really good, you know, lessons and education about television and broadcasting. And it wasn't until maybe 2 years after I got out of college and couldn't find a video gig anywhere that I discovered that Knoxville is just brimming with television production. And I just sort of slipped in the back door and discovered that, wow, you know, this has been happening my whole life all around me, and I had no idea how perfect that I should just happen to be born in Knoxville and be interested in film and television. And so that made me feel better about it. And now it's starting to, people in Knoxville are trying to get the film industry to start up here. And there's a lot of talk of people like, it's like, you know, Georgia is getting huge in film and television is changing into film. And it's a very bizarre time. And maybe I just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
You might be. I mean, you're right about Georgia is blowing up right now over the last few years, and not just from Walking Dead. I can name like a dozen shows where at the end they have their tagline, "Made in Georgia."
Oh, yeah, and you get that big, gorgeous, colorful peach or whatever at the end of it. And I think I read an article that they just signed on, like, 25 films and television series just decided we're going to Georgia. And I'm thinking the Southeast is just going to be huge in the next several years.
And you're right nearby Georgia anyway, so you're close.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And talking with people in Knoxville that are involved in film and actors, that it just seems that for whatever reasons, it's like the cosmos has aligned and everything very quickly has just started to drift into the Georgia area. And the talk around Knoxville and other parts of East Tennessee is, you know, we want to get in on that action, too.
Well, you guys have been having some success there.
We have been having some moderate success. I think we've got good people that are fighting for it to bring the industry here. But there seems to still be a little of hesitation. And I think, you know, part of it could be, you know, we've got a lot of television production, and mixing that with film, it's kind of a hard thing to get through. It might just be inevitable. It might just, you know, it might just happen because there's plenty of people just itching to get in on it.
Maybe. You know, I know that you've had some personal success, though, working with SAFTA and everything. I saw you guys cleaned house again, well, kind of, sort of, at the Knoxville Horror Film Fest this year.
Yeah, yeah. I was very happy with it. You know, the only thing is we were really hoping that we would sort of win the Triple Crown and get Best Film Award, but that went to somebody else this year. But we did get Audience Favorite and a few other awards, and it was a very satisfying year. And I definitely think very victorious, a lot of fun.
So now you start looking toward next year and building on the success, et cetera.
Yeah, and, you know, and looking forward, it's kind of like, well, you know, we've done this, and we've done a great job, but, you know, you want each year and each success you have, just step it up a little bit more. And part of it is trying to figure out, you know, well, how are we going to step it up a little bit more? And trying to think of, you know, in the back of my mind, almost about time to try to do a feature-length film. Whatever that is, though, I don't have a clue, or how to even make it happen at this point. I think that's where it's eventually got ahead.
Yeah. Right now you're doing, you know, short films, few minutes, not, you know, basically under 10.
Yeah. And, you know, short film, you know, they're great. They're a lot of fun. They're quick productions. You can put a lot of energy and detail into it. But at the end, you can't really do much with a short film. YouTube or Vimeo is really about it. There's some, you know, some places will screen a film. You can always enter it into a festival, but, you know, a short film doesn't really get out as much as a feature film. Even if a feature film is not as good as a body of short films, you get more life out of a feature film, I think. And people are more willing to let it travel around and are willing to watch it. And I think the hope and dream of any feature film is to get some sort of distribution, even if it's winds up in a red box somewhere. Been tons of filmmakers I've talked to that, you know, it's like, oh, we would dream to be, you know, a dollar rental in a red box. And of course, there's a lot of films in red box. If you've ever rented a horror film out of a red box and thought it looked good and then popped it in and realized it was far less than good, and you wonder, it's like, how did this even wind up in there? It's like, I don't know, but the filmmakers were probably ecstatic that you rented it.
It's like Netflix, you know, you go into the horror category and there's like a couple big names that you know, and then you start getting the ones below Asylum films even.
Yes. And you're like, and you start watching it and you don't know what it was shot on. And you know, there's still the modern day B movies, or I don't even know if they can be considered B movies, you know, some of these films, but there is a life that is given to them. And these, you know, terribly made movies are still getting around and still getting lots of attention, and it may be a bad movie, but you know, you go and tell your friend about it, and then they say, oh yeah, I watched that movie too, and everybody has seen this horribly made film.
Yeah, there's two of them that have really blown up in the last few years, and that's Tommy Wiseau's The Room and Birdemic.
I haven't heard of the second one. I know The Room, yeah.
I've also noticed a trend, thanks to the Sci-Fi Channel and everything now, of the we know it's a bad movie. And I don't know how you feel about it, but movies like Sharknado and everything, I don't like them, because my idea of a bad movie is a movie that really tried to be something and just fails.
You know, I think there's, you know, it's a funny concept. Yeah, when I watch a movie that I really believe is a bad movie, I can tell that they were really, really trying and just fell so horribly short. I think the other ones that are intentionally a bad movie, the whole thing is sort of one big joke, so you can get one big good laugh out of just the movie itself. But that's it, and it gets a little bit tired, but I don't completely hate it. I think for one thing, it just shows that there is a big marketplace for bad films. That the fact people are striving to make really bad movies like Snakes on a Plane and Sharknado just shows, as a culture, that we really started to adore poorly made, just bad movies.
When did that start?
I have no idea. It just seemed to have happened all of a sudden, or maybe it's always been that way and I just haven't noticed. But I think it definitely came around in the digital age. I think sort of spawned it a little bit more. And then all of a sudden people are striving to do some, you know, Corman-esque horror films. And there's huge audiences that just love it, and everybody seems to get it. Everybody seems to understand, yes, this isn't serious. We can laugh at it. And I think that's kind of fascinating to me.
I wonder if it's back a little bit further than the digital age. I wonder if it really starts with Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Well, I definitely think that's what created this generation of bad movie lovers. And what Mystery Science Theater, that was early 90s, I think. So yeah, and so everyone started really appreciating these bad movies. And then, of course, people start discovering the works of Ed Wood, and Ed Wood is, you know, is considered everybody's, you know, one of everybody's favorites, despite the fact that he was the world's worst director. And now we start to see in theaters, there's movies like Piranha and things like that, that you just know that everyone involved knew it was a bad movie. But it pulls people into the theater, and people really just are starting to enjoy crap.
But Piranha 2 did give us James Cameron.
There you go, yeah.
He was an assistant director on there, and he shot some of the footage and eventually had to take over most of the directing.
That is true. I'd actually forgotten about that.
That was another film that scared me as a child, coming back full circle, Piranha. Because my cousin, my teenage cousin at the time, really just went to great lengths to terrify me as a 5-year-old. So like, yeah, we're going to watch this movie about fish and we're at a camp on a lake, and bad idea to show that film to a 5-year-old who runs to his mother's, you know, legs crying, going, I hate my cousins.
I seem to remember another very jokey film that is pretty popular nowadays, Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, that's a great film.
It's fantastic. But I remember the first time I watched it, I don't know how old I was, I watched it and didn't catch on quickly that the whole thing was a joke. And it actually scared me to some degree. Not that I was even afraid of clowns, but there was some very creepy moments that actually freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, we all have our childhood traumas. I could see people being traumatized by that. And movies like Gremlins, where you don't see that ending coming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with absolutely.
Stripe melting in the sunlight and screaming.
Yeah, that's a very... That's a movie that even looks like a kid's film today. But yeah, that one really turns on you quickly. I remember seeing that and just thinking, wow, this movie really faked me out. I thought this was going to be gentle and you know, it kind of had this sort of goofy, happy, lightheartedness, and then all of a sudden was like, whoa, this is turning dark really quickly.
If you listen to the score, it does the same thing. You have the Gremlin Suite, which starts for about a minute and a half, is this soft music and everything, very 80s style, and then all of a sudden launches into the dark carnival style. Dun, 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 dun. And you're sitting there going, did not see that coming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you revisit those films that traumatized you as a child now that you're a filmmaker?
Oh, yeah. Well, I even did so as a child. You know, I'd see a film that would really scare me, and then I would want to go rent it later on. I think the ones that kind of would traumatize me or give me the most nightmares, they ended up turning out to all be comedies, more or less. For one thing, when I finally went back and watched Killer Clowns, then I realized, wait a minute, this whole thing is a comedy. This isn't a horror at all. Why was I so scared? And I was, you know, I was partly ashamed, but at the same time, it was an even better joke for me. And the same thing with, there was a film that I watched. It was a trauma film. It was the first trauma film I saw, called Monster in a Closet. And when I first saw this, I was terrified. I thought this was the scariest thing I have ever seen, and I would never even go near a closet because the whole thing was just this big, gross looking, you know, teeth ridden monster that would just burst out of your closet and drag the children into it. And then I finally was able to find a copy of it somewhere, or I bought it on DVD, and I was like, I'm gonna watch this because this really freaked me out. And the whole thing is this very, you know, sort of Mel Brooks-esque kind of comedy parody of horror films from the 1950s that I completely missed that part when I was a kid, because I was genuinely being terrified by it. And I watch it, and there's all these slapstick moments and, you know, people getting pied in the face and all these things that should have been obvious clues. But I was too traumatized by the joke to understand that it was a joke. And I'm just like, I don't know if that makes... To me, it just makes the movie a much better movie.
Well, it's interesting you bring up trauma, because I was just reading an article this week in honor of Halloween about famous head explosions in film.
Oh, really?
And they bring up Toxic Avenger and the famous scene of backing over the bicyclist's head.
Yeah.
I was really terrified to watch it. And I'm like, oh, God. Because Troma and I have a sordid history about the gore. I watch it and I'm like, okay, that's a cantaloupe and it's filled with cranberry sauce. I got it. So now my question to you is, as now someone who is a filmmaker and who has done horror films and schlock horror, grindhouse-type cinema,
yeah.
When you watch films, do you sit there and dissect them, or are you able to still kick back and just enjoy the film for what it is?
I think when it's a good film, I just naturally forget that I'm, you know, there to dissect it, essentially. I think the only time I really pick up on, on what's being done cinematically and technically is when the film gets to a weak point and I start looking for other things to look at rather than the story. But I think some of the best films will, I end up just forgetting that, I'm going to look for anything and I get totally sucked in. And a lot of times I do just get sucked into the story, but I'm always consciously aware that, of what's happening and I look for things that I haven't seen in other movies more than anything. But a really good film, my favorite films are the ones that seem to be made for filmmakers or people that love watching movies, which is one of the reasons I love Quentin Tarantino, because you'll watch his films and he gives you areas in the movie for you to watch and enjoy the technical aspect of the filmmaking. And then there's other moments where you just can't help but watch, enjoy, and get sucked into the story. But it's as though he made it for the purpose that I know people are going to be watching this film and wanting to pick it apart. So I'm going to give them those moments. I'm going to give them little, little picker moments. But then I want them to enjoy the real story, too. I've came to tell a story, and I need them to pay attention to that. So, then there'll be a scene where they'll get sucked in and just completely absorb the story. It's kind of back and forth. A good movie makes me not want to watch the technical parts. But then, if it's a really bad movie, then there's nothing else to look at.
That's true. You start looking for, did I just see the boom mic? This past week, I got to see Anaconda. Which I hadn't seen it in 17 years. I saw it in theaters and Riff Tracks Live. And 17 years later and film studies and, knowledge later, I'm sitting there going, holy shit, the waterfall is going in reverse to show the backup.
That was the first thing. When I watched that the first time, and I think I was 10, I asked everybody in the room, is that waterfall going backwards? And they're like, what? I remember the waterfall, and I was like, why is it going backwards? And I had no idea. I thought it was just an optical illusion. But that's so funny that you pointed out, because that was one of the first things I noticed watching that film.
I'm just watching it going, man, there are so many flaws in this story. And I just, in the words of Tom Servo, I wanted to reach out and smack that film so hard if I could.
That was, there's a lot I forgot about that movie, but and that movie too also kind of gave me the creeps when I saw it, and I was very little, and John Voight getting spat out, was kind of disturbing to me. But I do recall getting caught up with the fact that the punches sounded incredibly fake. And then I started thinking, yeah, I guess if you were making a film, you would have to have punch sound effects if the actors really weren't punching each other. And I got completely distracted by, what's happening in the movie, just thinking about, somebody was having to make punch noises.
And how do you do it? Do you actually hit somebody, or do you do the old stage Foley thing of slapping two pieces of meat together really hard?
Yeah, because the best punches, had that real poundy, meaty sound, and you just don't even think, about the sound effect. But then, this was, the old, whoosh, psh, it just has that whip sound to it, and it became more distracting than effective.
Maybe that's why we watch these bad films, so that we know what not to do.
I think watching a bad film is very educational for that reason. Even if it's not a technically bad film, if it's just a bad film, from a script standpoint or for whatever, from an acting standpoint, directing, watching a bad movie when you can tell this is a bad movie and then start to dissect it and figure out why is it bad, what could be done to make it better. I think that teaches more than watching a good movie. I mean, you could sit around and watch The Godfather all day and it not really help you know how to make a good movie. You just tell yourself, oh, this is a really good movie. But then when you watch a bad movie, when you can figure out how to fix the problems that made it bad, then you start to learn. I think it's very good to watch bad movies.
Are there some bad movies that you just absolutely love?
I love Ernest movies, the Jim Varney films. For one thing, they were some of my favorite when I was a kid. But even now, I just think, you know, these are like some of the most poorly made films ever. And I don't even know why I enjoy watching them, but I just love to like sit down and watch. It's like Ernest Goes to School. Let's watch it. And I just watch it. It's like, wow, this is really, really bad. But I'm having the time of my life right now.
I think it's all due to Jim Varney, honestly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was incredible. He was an incredible actor, but at the same time, he was such an over-actor in those films, and the films were so cheesy, and everything about it was just... But it puts you at ease because nobody is taking it too seriously, but they're taking it seriously enough to make it enjoyable. But there's not a lot you can really learn from watching them, I don't think. But
well, if you watch the TV series, you know, being that it was for children, it had to have some educational content. So
yeah, just you know. I don't know how much of it was actually educational, but
I've watched a couple episodes and I can say very little, but it's a hell of a ride.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it was definitely just, it was a bizarre phenomenon that I don't think could be duplicated or made better. It was just something that you had to admire it on its own merit.
I agree on that one.
I did have something I was going to say, and this was something that I had heard about but hadn't really studied on it until recently. And I forget even the name of the film, but it was this infamous unseen Jerry Lewis film.
It might be The Day the Laughter Died.
Or The Day the Clown Laughed. I knew about the film, and I knew it's like, oh, well, this is some sort of unseen film, but it wasn't until, you know, recently when they uncovered some behind the scenes footage of it, just about a year ago or so, that people started to get curious about it, and people were trying to find out more about the film. And of course, Jerry Lewis, who, you know, is now, you know, 106 years old, is being asked about it. And it's like, why can't we see this film? And he won't let anybody see it. And probably for good reason. When you think about a bad movie, and this apparently was, you know, about as big of a disaster as anything from what people have written about it. What a fantastic opportunity and learning experience it would be to get to see a film like that.
Yeah, there's only like three people who have seen it.
Yeah.
One is like Harry Shearer of The Simpsons and comedy fame.
Got
to see a private screening. Another film that's very similar to that is Tobey Maguire recut as an editing exercise. He recut the three Star Wars prequels into one film.
Really?
I think he just did the first one and it's called The Phantom Edit. Or something like that. He cut it. He cut out all of Jar Jar and made what, you know, because it's highly illegal what he did. He can't publicly show it.
Oh, absolutely.
But he showed it to some people and they all went, holy shit, this is a lot better than anything that was actually put out.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's like, that's the dream of many of us, to see that cut.
And I guess this is something that's not really very viewable then, I would imagine. Yeah, that would be, yeah, something like that would be interesting. It's a huge, and of course that comes back to, you know, bad movies being good teachers. If the fact that somebody turned that movie into something so much better just shows, you know, a bad movie can tell you the right way to go. It's a very fascinating thing, and it's something I like passing on to fellow aspiring filmmakers.
Somebody, it was a couple of years ago, what's considered to be the worst movie, Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Oh, my goodness, I love it.
At a eBay sale or like a estate sale, somebody came across a 16 millimeter master print of it.
Oh my goodness, you're kidding me.
They realized what they had on their hands, and it just so happened the person who bought it is a film restorer and has now begun creating a Blu-ray quality version of it.
Oh my goodness.
To preserve it.
I literally got chills just from the idea of it, because I only recently got into Manos. I hadn't even known about it until a few years ago, and I found it through the Mystery Science Theater channels. And yeah, I mean, that film is beyond anything that has ever been considered a bad film.
Roger Ebert was in favor before he passed. He was in favor of the restoration of it. And people were like, why is it? We need to preserve films like this.
Oh, absolutely. And the story behind it is so incredible. I mean, you just, everything about that, you know, film, it really did fascinate me, and it was a pain to watch. I mean, it's a very painful film to sit through, but, you know, then looking into the story behind it, and you're thinking, of course, this film from the beginning didn't even have a chance. It was written, directed, and acted by a fertilizer salesman in Texas. It never stood a chance to be good whatsoever. But yeah, now that it has not even this, you know, this incredible life and also a video game, which I have on my Android phone and have not yet beaten, but there's an 8-bit style video game of Manos, The Hands of Fate.
We'll have to send our listeners out to check that out.
Yes, Manos, the hands of Fate.
AKA Hands, The Hands of Fate, you know. And the master will not be pleased.
Master
is not going to go there, and then we could do this for a while.
If you cannot stay. I'll get your luggage. You cannot stay.
Well, there actually, somebody out there is trying to make a sequel of it now, too. An actual sequel to it. I know there was also a stage musical made of it.
That doesn't surprise me either. I don't know about the sequel, only because, you know, you can't really recreate, you know, the film and the way that it is. But I did talk to a friend. It was a filmmaker colleague of mine and also a rather decent actor. I told him about the film and I showed him the Torgo character. And I said, you know, I have this obsession now that I really want to make a film and have that character Torgo be in another film. I don't even know if that character could even be considered public domain, but you know, why not put Torgo, who of course is everybody's favorite character, in another film? And just imagine a mainstream stream film with Torgo in it. And I just became obsessed with that idea, but still haven't come up with any good reason to actually do it.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I'm ever up there in Knoxville and you're on a film shoot and everything, you can use me as Torgo and throw me in as a small cameo in the background somewhere.
We'll recreate the music and everything.
I used to use the theme actually on my radio show in the background sometimes when somebody annoying would come into the studio. I would start playing the Torgo theme behind them.
It was my ringtone until I got a new phone here recently.
Oh, the obsession with bad movies.
Oh my goodness.
So anyway, we're almost out of time. I can't believe it, man. It feels like, you know, even though it's been some time here, it just feels like gone by so fast.
That again is any time I can sit and just talk about movies and every, it, you know, it's never enough time, but so.
Well, we can have you back on to tell us about movies some other time. Maybe, how would you feel about maybe coming back in May and giving us a rundown of the summer movie season that we're up against in 2015?
That would be a fantastic idea. I would love to do that. Yeah.
We'll look into that. We'll look into that and see what the schedule's got on our minds here. Maybe like a mini episode.
Yeah. That sounds like marvelous good fun.
We'll see what we can do. It has been great having you on, Jameson. Truly.
Thank you very much. Yes, this is a blast.
Oh, it is indeed. Anytime I can sit and just bitch about movies with somebody who understands, I love it. So where can the folks find you online these days?
Currently, we've been talking about, for one thing, I'm going to finally create a Facebook page, I guess like a filmmaker's Facebook page for either just Jameson Stallsworth or Dr. Moonrat Films, which has kind of been my handle in the local film scene here, and also talking about making a website, just a place where I can have any of my film adventures just kind of in a collection where people can get to it. Because right now I'm pretty much just all over YouTube, and a lot of people have been asking, it's like, you should have a website. You know, I want to find your stuff easier. So that'll be coming hopefully in the next few months.
So where can they find you on YouTube?
Just Dr. Moonrat is the name of my YouTube channel or username. Most of my short films make their way to that channel, as well as some other random craziness that's not necessarily entertaining to everybody. But,
you know, as I used to say in improv theater, if it's just you laughing, that's still one person laughing.
I have had some fan followings, and people eventually find me on Facebook just from some random thing that I forgot I even put on YouTube. But most of my films are there and just floating around the interweb. But definitely YouTube.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to seeing what you're going to produce next, man.
All right.
All right. You take care of yourself. Have a good night.
All right. You too. Thank you.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.